Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Charlie Cook of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Still good, bad, and crazy martinis as usual for conservatives. And, Charlie, we begin with the president's trip to Raleigh, North Carolina yesterday. He fueled up Air Force One, went to Raleigh for a 19-minute speech, talk about income inequality and a few other things, some of which we'll talk about in the second martini as well. One of the fun side stories going into this appearance in Raleigh was the fact that, you know, Democratic North Carolina Senator Kay Hagan just couldn't quite squeeze this little trip into her schedule because, after all, the Senate was in session. I can't exactly think of any key votes that took place in the Senate yesterday, but, you know, she was just tending to her duties and couldn't be there. And, of course, the speculation is that, while the president is unpopular in most places, particularly in North Carolina, Hagan's poll numbers, as we'll talk about in a moment, aren't exactly that stellar right now against what are considered to be second-tier Senate candidates on the Republican side, while the president wasn't about to let Kay Hagan's absence go unnoticed. So here's what he had to say.
Your Senator Kay Hagan couldn't be here, but I wanted to thank her publicly for the great work she's doing.
And I'm sure, Charlie, that Kay Hagan's response is, gee, thanks, Mr. President.
Yeah, I bet she loved that, this battle she has on her hands. Now, I think the proximate cause of this is clearly Obamacare and also general disillusionment with the president, and specifically with his policies, with the unemployment rate, the economy in general, and with the agenda that he's really pushed the same thing from the beginning. But it's probably worth saying this is not limited to President Obama. This does happen to presidents. There are a few exceptions. Bill Clinton was reasonably popular at the end, and Ronald Reagan as well. But in general terms, presidents, once they get to this point, start to flag, and President Obama's approval rating has largely followed George Bush's if you superimpose one over the other. Now, the reason that that is important is not because Obama is somehow unique in having lost his charm, but because Obama was supposed to be messianic, he's supposed to be bulletproof. And if you compare the enthusiasm with which anyone and everyone threw themselves into Obama's orbit in the first few years of his presidency, and even before his presidency, to where he is now, the fall from grace is not only remarkable, but it's actually very welcome in a republic, regardless of your politics, to see that even a president who can stand in front of Greek columns and have so many column inches of fawning praise written about him, and in some regards be immune from criticism for the first few years, can fall as well. So, yes, I don't like the president, but I've been pleased to see other politicians start to back away from him just as a matter of civic virtue.
The latest numbers, and this is from a public policy polling, which obviously leans a little bit to the left, 38% approve of Obamacare, 48 disapprove. When it comes to matching up Senator Hagan against a number of different potential Republican nominees, she trails State Speaker of the House Tom Tillis, who leads the Republican field at the moment, 43-42. She also trails nurse practitioner Heather Grant, 42-41. She trails two other candidates by 2 percentage points, so they're all within the margin of error. But just a few months ago, she was pretty easily ahead of them. So it's obvious as the more this rollout goes, the more defense she has to play, and it's not quite clear how she's going to play it.
Well, I don't really know what she can do. As you say, this is very clearly the product of Obamacare. It's precisely when the fall started, was when Obamacare was rolled out. She was winning by a good margin until people saw the consequences. Now, the only way I think she can probably recover is if Obamacare recovers. If somehow, and before the 2014 elections, people start to say, well, this works, and you start seeing approval ratings tick up, then maybe she, as somebody who is seen as synonymous with that law in North Carolina, maybe she will recover. But other than that, she's very much in trouble. And frankly, given her vocal support for it, good riddance.
She had 43% approval in December. It's down now to 39%. Charlie, I was thinking, as you were mentioning that, one other potential strategy, and that's to paint the opponent as in some way completely unacceptable. You may hate what I did, but you should really be scared of that person. Is that pretty much how she's going to have to play this?
I think she'll probably try, but unless the person actually is unacceptable, and Republicans are very good at finding unacceptable, unlikable candidates who ruin their candidacies very early on, but unless the Republican Party does nominate somebody of that ilk, then she's going to have the same problem as Democrats had in 2010, which is that people go out to vote against the candidate in question and don't particularly care about their opponent because their opponent is either a nobody or is just seen as a general representative of the other party's ideology. So, no, unless she can actually pin some real problems on her opponent, that's not going to work.
All right, let's move on to the substance of the speech now. In our second martini, the bad martini, the president had said on Tuesday at the White House before reporters that he is not going to wait for Congress to pass the legislation he wants. He says he has a pen and he has an iPhone and he can sign executive orders and all sorts of other things. Here's how the president basically doubled down on that message again on Wednesday.
So Congress should do the right thing and extend this vital lifeline for millions of Americans. Of course, that's just short-term. Long-term, the challenge of making sure everybody who works hard can get ahead in today's economy is so important that we can't wait for Congress to solve it. Where I can act on my own without Congress, I'm going to do so.
And Charlie, I think the conservative response here would be that, yes, the president can sign executive orders, but they would also say that there's a track record here of this president signing executive orders that go above and beyond the parameters of that power, including changes to Obamacare, enacting much of the DREAM Act on his own, as well as some other things.
Well, as you know, this is something I write about a lot, and this is not an overstatement, but listening to the manner in which he speaks about this worries me, and it worries me for the future as well. It's not just an issue of this president, it's an issue of the presidency per se. What didn't happen, mercifully, in the clip that you just played, was the crowd cheering when he said Congress needs to act, needs to do the right thing, but I will do it if they don't. Normally, they do cheer. And really what they should do is shout, well, no, Mr. President, you will not. Congress, of course, has a right to make the wrong decision. The wrong decision is a matter of opinion. Congress's role is enumerated in the Constitution. There is no asterisk next to it that says, but if the president deems Congress to be intransigent or silly, he can just sign executive orders to get around them. Now, much of what we just heard is posturing. It's a way of hitting Congress and making himself seem more powerful than he is. But as you say, he has actually gone through with these threats before, with the DREAM Act, certainly with Obamacare. And probably more importantly, he does seem to have a view that if Congress will not act, but the American people are on his side, that he can do what they would have done. I mean, for example, with Syria, we saw this view that, well, I will consult with them, but if they don't come through, then I'll do it anyway. And with Obamacare, his argument has at times been, yes, but Republicans wanted this delayed anyway. Well, whatever they want, there is a system and a process. And I'm struggling in my knowledge of American politics to find a president who has been so openly dismissive, at least in the last 50 years, of the process that he swore to uphold.
As this goes forward, if he does in fact make good on some of those threats and there's not as much backlash as a lot of conservatives would like, it's going to be very interesting because we saw this before with, I think, recess appointments are the only thing he's actually gotten any real blowback on, right?
Yes, hopefully the Supreme Court will come through on that. It's interesting with this president. This is not a conservative talking point or accusation or double standard. He has been slapped down 9-0 by various courts for executive overreach more than every other president in American history. This is an objective judgment that the man has a lack of respect for checks and balances. And you only have to look at the way he talks, which I find deeply worrying. He talks about the American system as if it's contingent upon the people within it behaving rationally, which of course it's not. It's a legal system.
Charlie, well, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And of course, the president is expected on Friday to outline his ideas for NSA and intelligence gathering reforms. This, of course, following the NSA commission and reviewing everything that happened in light of Edward Snowden's revelations and several other things that have happened in recent months and years. So the New York Times today, with a relatively lengthy piece on the evolution of President Obama's thinking on this, because, of course, during the Bush administration, he was among those who were extremely critical of the warrantless wiretapping and many different other surveillance programs that he said were unconscionable, inconsistent with the Constitution. You know, we can kill the terrorists and protect rights at the same time. But, of course, as he's become president, he's embraced more and more of what the president did. And then a lot of this came to head with Edward Snowden. So here's the paragraph that's a lot of people smirking today. Quote, feeling little pressure to curb the security agencies, Mr. Obama largely left them alone until Mr. Snowden began disclosing secret programs last year. Mr. Obama was angry at the revelations, privately excoriating Mr. Snowden as a self-important narcissist who had not thought through the consequences of his actions. And I know a lot on the right are trying to hold up a mirror for the president on that one.
Well, I'm very critical of the NSA, at least domestically, as I'm sure you know. But it was always obvious that the manner in which President Obama spoke about executive power and about national security and about foreign policy when he wasn't President Obama was a combination of naive and politically minded. He has to have known, even if he's more of a civil libertarian and more of a non-interventionist like I am, he has to have known that there was so much that he didn't know. He has to have known that he would come into office, and even if he had his own views, that there would be a certain amount of pressure that would push him to make decisions, that there would be a structure in place that would be difficult and slow to overturn. He has to have known that some of the things that the United States does that he doesn't like, and maybe I don't like either, he would make the decision to continue purely because he didn't want to be responsible. That's what people in power do. That's why they need checking very often, but that is what people in power do. It's interesting to me the degree to which the rhetoric has finally ceased to be enough. The left has turned on him on this question, finally. But if you go back to England, where I'm very clearly from, and you ask people, well, why do you like President Obama? They will say, well, because Bush was crazy. God, with all the drones and the waterboarding and the extraordinary rendition and Guantanamo Bay. They think Guantanamo is closed. They think that the national security apparatus of the Bush administration is gone. And the reason they think that is because President Obama spent an awful lot of his time effectively implying that the second he became president, it would all end. And it was never going to end. It was naive and dishonest for him to have suggested it would. And if anything, he's expanded and ossified it.
Well, we'll certainly see what he has to say tomorrow. Charlie, as always, great to have you with us. Thanks for filling in. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you so much for having me.
Charlie Cook of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Friday, as will I. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us then for the Friday edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.